9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
So there really is a space race here, and it's to achieve what is known as quantum supremacy. And that effectively means when a quantum computer can complete a task that, in effect, a conventional computer never would be able to.
As with every race, there are contestants.
You've got a number of different companies like Google, IBM, Intel, Microsoft, all trying to build these quantum computers.
I think the Chinese, with this as with other technologies that they've identified as the commanding heights, they want to be number one.
There are the crowds watching from the stands.
It seems that the time has come where companies have realized that there is a revolution underway.
Warren Buffett has said often that anyone who, over the last 200 years, bet against the United States' ability to solve complicated problems lost that bet.
And then there are the stakes.
49 qubits starts to get to the quantum supremacy, which means that the quantum system is more powerful than any other computing capability on the planet.
Whoever gets there first will have, for some significant period of time, real advantages in intelligence collection, analysis, and everything that that drives.
In part two of our series on quantum computing, we learn about the different bets being made by tech giants in the global race for quantum supremacy. The question is, who will cross the finish line first?
This is the future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is The Future of Everything.
Hi, I'm Jack Nickus, and I've covered Google for the Wall Street Journal, and I wrote the story on quantum computing for the Future of Everything magazine. So quantum bits leverage the power of quantum mechanics to have atoms or particles in two states at once or even two places at once, and that is what's called superposition.
It's one of the things that could give a fully functional quantum computer unprecedented power. Think of it like a coin toss. With a typical computer, you can get heads or tails.
You can only land on one, but qubits are like coins that are spinning through the air during the coin toss, showing both heads and tails at the same time.
But what makes a quantum computer so powerful?
The extreme power of a quantum computer is actually locked in the fact that adding a single qubit to a quantum chip actually doubles its computing power. It doesn't incrementally improve it, like adding a single bit to a traditional computer. It doubles it. So at 3 qubits, I have 8 classical bits. By the time I get to 10 qubits, I'm up to 1,024 classical bits. By the time I get to 20 qubits, I'm up to more than 1,000,000 classical bits. And that means when I get to 300 qubits, I'm actually to more bits than there are atoms in the known universe.
As strange as it all sounds, a number of companies are starting to make significant progress working on these qubits.
You've got companies like Google, IBM, Intel, Microsoft, all trying to build these quantum computers. And the interesting thing is they're all going about it in different ways.
The first approach to get to market was a type of quantum computer meant for specific kinds of computing, made by Canadian company D-Wave.
I'm Bo Ewald. I'm the president of D-Wave International, and our company has created the world's first commercial quantum computers.
Years ago, he ran computing at Los Alamos National Laboratory, one of the largest science and technology institutions in the world. It's there that he met the man known as the father of quantum computing, physicist Richard Feynman.
I met him in 1983, and he gave this talk, Tiny Computers Obeying Quantum Mechanical Laws. And it was the first time I'd ever heard of such a thing. And we, at the time, were the most powerful supercomputing center in the world. And so a couple of days later, Feynman and Edward Teller and Hans Bethe and other Nobel laureates wanted to see what modern computing was like at Los Alamos. So, and Feynman turned to me and said, and I can't do his accent, and you won't be able to see his fingers, but he sort of pointed his both fingers at me like they were guns and said, "You know, young man, someday all these big supercomputers are going to be replaced by quantum computers."
What D-Wave machines do well is solve optimization problems.
whether you're trying to optimize or balance a portfolio, or if you're Federal Express and you're trying to make sure that you have the optimum routes for your trucks, or you're filling up your aircraft with the right number of parcels and you have various constraints. Those are all optimization problems. Or if you're building cars and you have to have all of the parts show up at the right time to be able to assemble the car, and what you want to optimize or minimize in this case probably is the cost, and you don't want to have to wait.
A lifelong pilot, Ewald's favorite analogy for how these computers work is best understood from the air.
Let's go flying.
Yay!
And what I didn't know is that we'd be doing this in something that looks like what you'd see in an air show, a vintage military fighter plane. Also, he likes to fly stunts.
Beachmanner 4, Mike X-ray, departing 1-6, left traffic. Here we go.
Looking out from the plane, the analogy works like this. In this quantum state, you see all the answers at once. The peaks of mountains represent the least correct answers, and the lowest valley, that represents the best answer. D-Wave's type of quantum computing, called annealing, is suited for specific kinds of problems. And it doesn't come up with a definitive answer, but one that's based on probability. Other companies, including Google, IBM, Intel, and a startup called Rigetti, are using superconductors to build a completely different kind of quantum computer. Jack Nickus.
Google creates that by essentially running an electrical current through the superconducting material, and I believe in some cases it's just aluminum, and they run a current through the aluminum two different ways at once. And that is what creates the superposition. That's both the one and the zero at the same time. Intel, meanwhile, they use this thing called spin electrons. So they get electrons to spin in two different directions at once.
Last episode, we visited the IBM research lab working on a 50-qubit chip. Google is testing a chip with 49 qubits, and now Intel has one too.
49 qubits starts to get to the quantum supremacy, which means that the quantum system is as powerful as, or more powerful than any other computing capability on the planet.
Brian Krzanich is the chief executive of Intel. He says they're also working on chips he believes will be easier to scale.
Because these are all cryogenic. They're running at like 250 times cooler than deep space. So we're also working on silicon-based spin-modeled qubits, which I think will really, if we can finish those over the next few years, then those have the real possibility to work at much higher temperatures and have much larger scale.
Meanwhile, Rigetti is using photons to build their quantum computer.
And in effect, as the bizarre laws of quantum mechanics dictate, the photon is kind of both there and not there at the same time.
There are other approaches too, but they only get stranger from here.
There's another startup on the East Coast called IonQ, and they essentially trap an ion, and they spin it in two different directions, and they use lasers to manipulate that for the computations. And then there is Microsoft, which probably has the strangest approach, but in some ways the boldest approach, because you would say maybe they are the farthest behind others, because Microsoft is still trying to kind of build its first quantum chips, and that's because Microsoft is betting on something called a Majorana particle. And a Majorana particle is actually a theoretical particle. We don't even know if a Majorana particle exists.
And yet, if Microsoft pulls it off, the company could jump ahead of everyone else, because at least in theory, this method could be extremely resistant to errors, a huge problem for quantum chips.
But when I asked Todd Holmdahl, who is the head of Microsoft's quantum computing team, whether these Majorana particles actually exist, he said, "I'm not absolutely certain." And he's talking about something that Microsoft is betting its entire quantum computing future on.
And now Google is preparing for a test that could prove quantum supremacy, the so-called tipping point where a quantum computer does something impossible for any other machine. But what does it take for a quantum computer to prove itself?
It is an extremely obscure computational problem, and it's almost pointless for me to try to explain because it doesn't have any real use. It really is just an abstract equation that serves to prove the computational power of the quantum computer.
In a small lab outside Santa Barbara, stocked with surfboards and acoustic guitars, 24 Google physicists and engineers are preparing to put their chip to this test, something that would take a regular computer billions of years to complete.
Oh, hi, I'm John Martinez, and I'm a professor of physics at UC Santa Barbara and also a research scientist at Google. About a year and a half ago, the theory team down in LA came up with a theory on how to do this. And, well, lo and behold, it may work.
My name is Daniel Sank. We are in the main experimental lab at the Google facility in Santa Barbara.
He's part of the team of researchers preparing for this experiment. He shows us what Google's qubits look like.
So somewhere in the middle of the chip, you see some plus signs, just little crosses.
Yeah.
Okay, so those crosses are the actual qubits.
Wires that look like little curvy lines carry signals from the outside into the qubits. In order to make it behave quantum mechanically, you have to get it really, really cold.
So that's why we have these giant refrigerators. So this is a helium dilution refrigerator. It gets down to about 15 millikelvin, which is actually considerably colder than deep space, which I think is really awesome. We have a thing right here in front of you that is colder than deep space. So we put the qubits in there, and then they behave quantum mechanically because they get cold enough.
Between keeping them cold and keeping them stable, qubits are very hard to control.
Can you just describe a little bit for us how bizarre the laws are in comparison to how we experience the world?
I'm going to say something that's a little controversial because I have strong feelings about this question. It's not that hard. It's no harder than Newton's laws. It's just new and different, and you just have to learn it. And you know, it sounds totally bonkers when you first learn this idea that things exist in multiple places at the same time. But you know, the fact of the matter is that nowadays you can walk into that lab next door and you can run an experiment and you can see that this stuff actually works on things that we can build.
As many reasons as there are to be excited about this research and the eventual arrival of such large-scale computing, there's also cause for concern.
And that's because they pose the threat of being able to break the encryption that today secures our credit card transactions, our health records, text messages, and just about everything we do online. And that's because these quantum computers can break modern day encryption. And basically what we use today is something called public key cryptography, where an enormous number, several hundred digits long, acts as a lock on our encrypted data. And the key to that lock are that enormous number's two prime factors. So a classical computer like the ones we use, it would take them years to find those two prime factors. But quantum computers, in theory, could find those factors almost instantly.
And so governments, as well as companies, are scrambling to prepare for what many in the industry are dubbing Y2Q. That's the year researchers estimate this powerful quantum computer could arrive.
And some experts are talking about 2026 as potentially being that year. So what we're already seeing evidence that the government is worried about this. So the National Security Agency, the U.S. government's one of their leading spy agencies, in 2016, they issued an order to some of their NSA employees and security vendors saying that they needed to overhaul their encryption method. These encryption methods need to be in place before large-scale quantum computers arrive. And if not, it would be, quote, devastating to national security.
If you're trying to write a spy novel, you want to choose a topic that you think is going to get hotter, not colder.
That's David Ignatius, the best-selling novelist behind 10 spy thrillers. The most recent is The Quantum Spy.
What made this book fun for me was that I decided to choose two pieces around which to stitch that traditional spy novel plot. One was quantum computing. Sometimes we talk about the MacGuffin in spy novels or thrillers. You know, it's the thing everybody's chasing, but what is it? Well, in this case, the thing everybody's chasing is a real working quantum computer.
Ignatius is a journalist, and it shapes how he approaches his novels.
I was doing a lot of reading in the Snowden papers that were released in the Washington Post and other newspapers, and I saw in one of the documents that we published, which was the so-called black budget for the intelligence community, that the National Security Agency had been spending a lot of money for a while on quantum computing research. So that got me interested. That's really the first point at which I realized that this had been a significant government program. And then there was so much online just looking at unclassified IARPA grants to all of the companies.
Looking into this mysterious government project sent him down a research rabbit hole.
you know, I'm basically a reporter when I sit down to do my novel. So I did a lot of reporting, talked to a lot of people, and then sent them the pages for the manuscript that dealt with the technical points to make sure I wasn't saying anything too ridiculous. So I traveled both to Seattle to see Microsoft folks and to Vancouver to talk to Gordy Rosen and to actually look at the D-Wave machines in operation. Also a woman named Krista Svor is already writing a programming language for the quantum computer that Microsoft wants to build.
So what did he learn talking to all these researchers?
No encrypted system will stay safe. You know, as I thought of this, I thought, if you get real breakthrough news on quantum computing, what's the implication of that for Bitcoin, a machine that can shred encryption? I don't know. I do think that this is one of those technologies where whoever gets there first and has the degree of mastery of digital space that this would imply will have for some significant period of time real advantages in intelligence collection analysis.
And China in particular is investing heavily, including plans to build a $10 billion quantum research center.
They have pioneered this idea of using quantum encryption, passing messages back and forth between a satellite and a ground station. So I think the Chinese, with this as with other technologies that they've identified as the commanding heights, they want to be number one.
And so countries as well as companies are racing toward a quantum age. But how close are we?
My name is Daniel Adar. I'm a professor of electrical engineering and chemistry and physics at the University of Southern California.
He's been working in quantum computing for more than 20 years.
I don't believe we will have quantum iPhones, but the chairman of IBM famously said at one point that there's probably a market for only one large classical computer, IBM computer. So those kind of predictions are very dangerous. But it appears to be the case that at least in the foreseeable future, quantum computers will be highly specialized.
He says it's difficult to make definitive statements about who is leading in this race. And a breakthrough, in particular with Microsoft's approach, would reshuffle the deck.
The time has come where companies have realized that there is a revolution underway. Academics are more cautious about the impact of this revolution. It looks like we're on the cusp of quantum computing actually starting to make a difference in real-world applications. We're not there yet, but we're approaching that point. It seems closer than ever before.
In a moment, a look at our next episode. The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. The show is produced by Laura Sim. John Wurdock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. This episode was co-produced by The Wall Street Journal's Sarah Castellanos and by Jack Nickus, with special thanks to Stephen Rosenbusch and Tom Loftus. Algorithms could help improve access to healthcare, education, housing, and other services. But just how fair are these mathematical formulas? Next time, what happens when we hand over important decisions to software? Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from the Newsroom in New York.
So now it's going to be your turn to fly.
I'm really happy letting you fly.
You won't get it gooped up, though.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.